Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle.
So restorative practice, restorative justice, is more about taking people and putting them in space, making what happened understandable to all, and bringing the humanity back into how we resolve issues amongst each other.
And I think one of the most challenging conversations that we have in any of the work, whether it's in a workplace, whether it's in a school, part of the justice system, is what is accountability to a crime? What is justice to a crime? And one of the things I think is really critical to understand about restorative philosophy is that it isn't just about a reaction to something bad that happens. It really has a heavy focus on prevention as well.
Hello, all. This is Judy with Wellness Renaissance and the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. We have a fantastic conversation for you today. If you are not familiar with what restorative justice or restorative philosophy or restorative practices are, this is a great opportunity to learn what this is all about and hear how Paul and Lorraine Mickelson, the voices you just heard, are doing some amazing work that is literally changing lives and communities and rippling out into who knows what possibilities. And they're going to tell you some of the stories and experiences that they have had. But they're going to talk about exactly what it is and how it works. And you got a little taste at the beginning there, kind of giving you a little bit of a foundation. But it's fantastic, the work that's going on in schools and work and within our justice system. It's pretty clear to most of us that our system of punishment doesn't quite work the way that we think it should. So it's really great to know that there are people working out there in schools and workplaces and beyond to try and do something different and to help facilitate the conversations and the great need that we have to understand how to make some headway by asking some really hard questions and examining things from a really different angle. So I'm excited for you to hear this because it's just really fascinating stuff, something that we can potentially get involved in if it makes sense to do so. And they're, like I said, they're going to tell some great stories about their experience. They are currently doing some amazing work with the Cloquet Area Alternative Education Program. And I love that Paul comes to this with 26 years of working in the prison system. So he has a very solid firsthand look of what the experience is there. So I'm just super excited to share this with you. Check it out. Be inspired for our world. We all need a little bit of that. We all need a lot of that right now. And this is, for some, very direct and tangible. But if we could watch the ripples go out, we would probably see that it helps all of us in big or little ways. So listen on. This is fantastic. Before we dive in, just a few things. First of all, thank you so very much for listening to this episode and the podcast. Please do check out the other episodes at wellnessrenpodcast.com. You will see all the other episodes available there. You can, of course, subscribe on iTunes. Sign up for the email notifications on the website. Then the podcast is just a click away. Super simple. I sincerely want to thank you for those of you who are supporting the podcast by sharing the podcast, be it forwarding on an email or sending it through Facebook. However you are sharing the podcast with those who might be interested, I am so appreciative. Thank you so much to those of you who are a part of the Patreon community supporting the podcast. We really sincerely appreciate that and supporting the mission and helping us make sure that it can continue to happen. If you are interested in supporting the podcast in that way, you can do that for as little as $1 a month. You can just hop on the website, wellnessrenpodcast.com, and you will see Become a Patron button. And there's various levels you can choose from and get some goodies for being part of the gang. So thank you. And speaking of Patreon members, we have a new supporter on Patreon, Lorraine from Barnum. Wonder who that could be. Thank you so much and welcome. Without further ado, let's head on in with Paul and Lorraine Again, they are mediators, trainers, and facilitators for restorative justice practices. And they have so much passion for this, and they're doing some great stuff. So enjoy and be inspired.
Well, welcome to both of you guys. Thanks for hanging out with me today. I'll have you both introduce yourself. Let's start there, and we're going to talk about restorative justice and what that means and how that looks with all the work you're doing. So whoever wants to start.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Judy, for having us be a part of your podcast. We're so incredibly grateful to you for being able to share information about what this word, you know, or this concept really of restorative justice is, or sometimes I like to refer to it as restorative philosophy, partly because this work that we're moving into in this country and other countries as well is becoming bigger and sometimes harder to define and harder to maybe understand. So, but anyway, my name is Lorraine Mickelson. I am a consultant and trainer in the field of restorative philosophy. And I have done a lot of work in the justice system, in this idea of what is restorative justice and how, and really what does this mean in terms of maybe partnering or maybe restructuring our criminal justice system to something that looks a little bit different from what it currently is. Mm-hmm. I've also done a lot of work within our school systems. And in schools, we refer to this restorative work as restorative practices. Just a little bit different. The philosophy really is the same, but some of the tools that we utilize within the school systems might look a little bit different. And then also thinking about this work and kind of carrying it over into just a typical workplace. This idea about restorative philosophy is really about developing relationships. It's really about creating a good, strong community of people, and whether the community of people work together, whether they're brought together because of a crime that has occurred, or whether they're brought together because of maybe there's a conflict in the school system, or maybe there's been an incident of harm. Regardless of what that incident is, it really can be navigated through this philosophy called restorative work.
It's an interesting thing. Like you were saying, the different words, restorative philosophy or restorative practices, I think restorative justice has this potential to go, oh, that's for those people, right? The whole justice, right. That's not about me. Where this is, you're bringing it in to say that this is about being human. This is about functioning in the world and in our daily lives.
I completely agree. I really, really see it as that bigger picture. And it's you know, we may, us that are in this work of restorative work, we really look at this as being a way of life in terms of how I bring myself into the world each day, how I bring myself into my relationships each day with individuals. And so, yeah, it becomes bigger than just this activity book that we might fill out. It becomes bigger than just a process that we might have somebody work through to try to repair harm because maybe there was a crime that occurred, and we're going to use this restorative philosophy, and we're going to use maybe a sentencing circle to try to mend the harm to the victim or victims of that particular crime. So it becomes bigger than just a process. It really becomes a way of being. It really becomes an identity. And I think a perfect example of that is just working with an alternative school that I've been at for the last 3 years. They're students from this school. They're called ambassadors that work in this school that have been trained in restorative philosophy and how to navigate conflicts between themselves and with other students and with students and teachers. They actually themselves were on a podcast with the Department of Education, and I so admired how they talked about this work with them, because it really has become part of their identity and who they are. Some of their language was, you know, we are a restorative school. I am a restorative student at this school. And so it becomes just this way of life, and it's just, it's really a beautiful thing.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Would you like to introduce yourself? The silent person so far over here.
Sure. Well, how can you top that? I'm Paul Mickelson. I'm also with Mickelson Consulting, and I am a mediator and trainer and facilitator for restorative justice, restorative practices, processes and philosophies. I also worked in the justice system for one of our local counties and developed and implemented a restorative justice program for at-risk youth, and did that for about 5 years. I would kind of capitalize a little bit more about how this work is all about building relationships. So restorative practice, restorative justice, is more about taking people and putting them in space, making what happened understandable to all, and bringing the humanity back into how we resolve issues amongst each other. I think often now, especially in the justice system, we think that the answer to all the issues and problems are the police or the courts or prisons, which, by the way, I have 26 years into working in prisons. And they're just not equipped to deal with the issues that we want them to deal with. They are there more about public safety. They're not diving into why people have found themselves there, what needs to be done to repair the harm that they've caused, who needs to be part of that conversation. And we've kind of eliminated that whole end of it from this dialogue around crime. And you can see, if you go anywhere now and talk to people how they feel about the prison system or the justice system, most folks, when they go through it or have been part of it, don't find much satisfaction in it. But sit them in a process, sit them in a circle, have them start talking about how to repair harm, what they've done to one another, and what needs to be done to make amends. You'll find people go, that's what we need to do as far as dealing with some of the issues that need to be dealt with. And this punishment end hasn't served us well. I mean, if you look, just look at the criminal justice system. We had a population of about 300,000 folks in prison in about 1970. And in 2014, when we got tough on crime, three strikes and you're out, mandatory minimums, now we're at about 2.4 million. We incarcerate more humans in this country than anybody on the planet. And we're supposed to be kind of this leader in free thought, free speech, democracy.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I was thinking about, like, you and you were saying the whole, you know, when people think to the justice system, that they're not happy with it. And I can think of the response from many people would be, well, of course you didn't like the justice system because you were the one who got punished. But it's not even that. It's the people who just have to deal with the system in any way they don't feel like it's a good system, it's an easy system, and nobody walks out of it most of the time. I can speak to one person who's been on the podcast who walked away from it a better person because of what he was able to turn his prison sentence into. But there's not enough help or something in the mindset. And then I think of, like, documentaries I've seen in other, like, countries or the prisons where there becomes community, and I imagine it is sort of around restorative and relationships, where the people in the prison are like, they're okay to, like, being there isn't the worst thing in the world, and they're learning stuff and they're gaining things. And then some people look at that and say, well, you shouldn't enjoy your time in prison. But it's like, but if you're gaining a forward momentum about how to function in the world and it's not horrible, we don't, you know, I grew up that, you know, church and work, those two things had to be miserable or you weren't getting the job done, right? And it's like, I don't think that that's true, and I don't think that has to be true with prison and learning how to be a better person. We know we learn better by laughing, by having experiences, and just by being punished, we're then defensive.
Well, we've created this system around fear. I mean, if you think about what most of the laws are, and I know growing up listening to what my parents used to say is, boy, you don't want to go to prison. You know, that's a bad place. And if you get into trouble in the law, I'll never talk to you again. Or if you do this, you know, this whole retributive model. And then taking it, I mean, just fashioning the system after, you know, this ancient idea of it's a crime against the state, it's not a crime against the other person. So you take the other person completely out of the equation, the victim usually, and the state takes over, And if you talk to most people who go through that system or encounter it, even the ones who are bringing charges, they walk out of there pissed. Mm-hmm. It doesn't satisfy their needs. And if that's the case, then what we need to do is reevaluate. But we don't seem to want to do that. Then take that to schools. Think of the punishment and how they talk about it in schools. No tolerance. Three strikes, you're out. We model our school discipline completely after our justice system. And if I can't think of a worst example to model a hierarchy after, is that. But that's what we do. Because, again, we're taking something that we think works, because most people you talk to them, I'm going to prison, we'll never see him again. Wrong. In probably about 28 months, you're going to see him right back in your community, more pissed off, less able to get a job, and more willing to make your community unsafe. And it's just the opposite effect of what we thought we were getting out of this idea. Now, we're doing the same thing with schools. We wonder why we have children getting automatic weapons, going in and shooting them up. Look, I'm not here to berate or belittle these systems. I think people are going after it the best way they think they know how. Mm-hmm. And they think that retribution is best teacher. And what I think we need to do is say, no, it isn't. If I violate a crime, especially a youth, and when I'm talking youth, I'm talking from 15 to 28, okay, because that brain is not formed yet. But the magic number 18, you become this adult,
yeah,
which is insanity.
Yes,
the frontal lobe isn't even, especially with men, and my wife will tell you that my frontal lobe is still under development.
How old are you?
Yeah, and I'm 60. But to think that teaching them about this retribution and this fear is going to make them into better human beings and make your community safer is such crap. Because, and I'll we don't learn when we're fearful.
Right.
We know what to be afraid of. If you look at schools, suspension, detention, 90% of your students never use it. Why? Because that model is okay with them, because they know that they don't want to be in there. But the people that we're spending most time with in schools, the 10%, love it. Get me my suspension. I want to go home. I got weed and the Xbox, and I'm a happy man, because I know both of my folks are out working trying to make the ends meet, and your little suspension thing, whatever. Mm-hmm. And how many of those children are we losing, right, to the prison population, mm-hmm, because we're not maybe responding to them maybe a little differently? Because that 90%, we're never really going to have to worry about. They're going to follow the rules. They're going to go along. No matter what we do, mm-hmm, they're going to follow those rules.
Right.
We want to bring that 10% back into the fold. And that's how restorative practice and coming at them a little bit differently is going to impact that population. And maybe we won't lose as many.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's a lot more to what has just been said as well. I mean, if we look at whether it's criminal justice, whether it's suspension, detention, whether it's restorative justice, what we're looking at here is what kind of outcome are we seeking? I mean, at the end of anything, at the end of any of these processes, at the end of a person's sentence, and maybe a person is going on parole or probation, or maybe a student's coming back from suspension, what is it that we're truly seeking? What outcome is it that we're wanting to have happen with anything that we try to do, any kind of intervention that we have? And I think one of the most challenging conversations that we have in any of the work, whether it's in a workplace, whether it's in a school, part of the justice system, is what is accountability to a crime? What is justice to a crime? What does punishment look like in a school system? So if an assault occurs within a school system, or maybe there's a theft, or maybe there's bullying, what is it? You know, what is the appropriate response? And what does punishment, and I hear that word so often, regardless of where I'm at, whatever mm-hmm. system I'm working in, what is it that we need to get out of this? What kind of pound of flesh can we get from this person, you know, so that we make sure that they understand that what they did was just this terrible thing? And so In our work, the definition of justice is critical. It's a critical conversation to have. So if we're in restorative justice and we're having conversations about crime that caused harm, what does really justice look like? And how does anybody define that particular word? And we have this amazing little tool that we use, and we ask people to draw a picture of justice. We give them a piece of paper and a pen, and we say, just draw a picture of what justice looks like to you. No words, nothing, just a picture. And I tell you, Judy, what we find from the pictures that people draw, and whether it's a 2-year-old, whether it's somebody that's 80-year-old, oftentimes we're doing this at our local county fair, is just astounding to us. Now, sometimes we see crosses, and sometimes we say justice equals peace, but probably 75 to 80% of the time, what we see people draw are handcuffs, are police cars, are guns and weapons.
Prison bars,
police officers. And just that question, and you can ask this question of anybody, you'll be flabbergasted at the response that you see. That question alone tells us a little bit, it gives us a little glimpse into our culture and what our culture really thinks justice is. Right. And that's it's a critical conversation to have, because nobody can really define it. And I think people can't define it because it's such an emotional experience. It's an emotional term. It's not something that's 2 + 2 = 4. We just don't get there. And I think in the same thing with schools, when we think about what is accountability in a school, if one student hits another student, what needs to happen? Mm-hmm. So it's not, maybe we're looking for justice in the school system, but maybe we're looking for accountability as well. And when we ask school administrators, when we ask teachers, what is accountability for this type of behavior, we get different answers across the spectrum, different perspectives. And that's wonderful. It's wonderful to have different perspectives. That's great. And yet, when a school, in a sense, is trying to be consistent in their response to behavior, or they have a parent that's calling the principal constantly because maybe this student is impacting or bullying their son or daughter, how is a principal to respond to that? And I think, you know, partly what Paul and I are saying is that we're not, you know, restorative practices, restorative justice, however you're looking at that, we're not trying to deconstruct everything that's currently in place. This is really about supplementing and complementing what exists, what is really working to get the outcomes that we're seeking.
Absolutely. You'll see, especially when I was working in the justice system, you'll see police officers often will be saying, I shouldn't have to deal with this kind of a thing. This isn't something that fits what I do. I want to charge a felony to a 13-year-old because they have an iPhone that they took from somebody else, when really, you know, maybe some learning here, maybe some other intervention would work a lot better.
Are you saying the police officer says that the restorative justice piece isn't what they do?
Oh, no. Sometimes what they're saying is that I don't want to use the criminal justice system for this particular intervention. I wish I had something else. Now, what I will say to you is that you'll have some people in law enforcement that think this is a decent and a good way to go about things, but you'll have others who are still stuck in the retributive past that thinks that the only thing that folks need is a punishment for a crime, when really, I want people to learn from mistakes. I don't want them... Let me put it to you this way. We talked about... Lorraine brought up accountability. It is far more accountable to go into a room with a person that you've caused harm to and find a way to make things right when you're looking at the person that you've been involved with. It is far more impactful for that offender and far more impactful for the victim when they together figure out what needs to be done to repair the harm that's been caused. Instead of some entity in a black robe going $25 fine.
Right.
And what you'll find is, especially with youth, and I would say when I'm using that youth from 13 to 28, when they learn that what they've done actually has impact to another person and mm-hmm. see it, it changes how they behave in the future, almost always. Now, you're going to always have somebody who will say, well, I can point to this particular guy that didn't learn a thing and didn't, right. and he keeps doing it, and all you're doing is giving him another break. Well, I can also point to people who have completely changed their lives because of it too. What I'm saying is you're going to have varying degrees of success along the spectrum, but what I've always seen is people making better choices after they've gone through something like this than when they went through the regular criminal justice system.
Right.
I'd also like to point out, we're talking a lot about a reactive response, mm-hmm. right? We're talking about something happened. An incident happened at a school, there was a crime committed, and we're talking a lot about what do we do after the fact. And one of the things I think is really critical to understand about restorative philosophy is that it isn't just about a reaction to something bad that happens. It really has a heavy focus on prevention as well. So how do we prevent harm from occurring in the first place? How do we prevent crime from occurring in the first place? I mean, that's a big question that restorative practitioners ask all the time. So this isn't necessarily about coming in after the fact, but developing a community through the utilization of what this restorative processes are all about, so that we can support people in developing good relationships at home, good relationships at school, and good relationships in the mm-hmm. workplace. And so when we talk with, let's say we're talking with a school that is very interested in doing something in this idea of restorative practices, but they're not sure what direction to go down to or to start with. I mean, one of the things that we talk about is, let's really talk about utilizing the talking circle process to develop good relationships between some of the students first. Mm-hmm. And let's have some fun with it. And let's play around with it. And for the first year, let's just practice this idea and see what we come up with. And not only just say that this is just an intervention for when something bad happens. I think that's a critical piece to, you know, the work that we're talking about, and a critical point in understanding really what this is all about.
Well, and then you move that to the workplace, right? Mm-hmm. So that's another venue we're working in. And we've worked with, I've worked with a number of different private, nonprofit, and government agencies, and you can see how companies are starting to now look at ways to focus on the relationship between employees mm-hmm. using restorative practices, and how those relationships really impact the quality of the products and services they deliver to the folks that they work for. Because, just like in the criminal justice system, just like in the schools and in the workplace, this is all about us starting to talk to one another again, starting to sit down and figure out what we need from each other so that we can be better with one another, instead of somebody else deciding for us what needs to be done to make things better. Mm-hmm. And what people are finding in schools, the criminal justice systems, and businesses is it's worth the investment. It's worth the time, because the outcomes are getting better. They're changing from the normal way. And you look at where schools are sitting, where the criminal justice system and the workplaces are sitting. Mm-hmm. We can't afford to have people come and go. We can't afford mm-hmm. to not do something with this massive amount of people who are incarcerated or coming back into our community now. You know, people need to realize very few of those incarcerated offenders stay there forever. Mm-hmm. The massive amount come back into our communities.
Right, and having them prepared to come back in the community with in a better way, with some mm-hmm. tools under their belt. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, what you're saying, and I'm thinking about, like you're saying, that the student said we're a restorative school. It's talking about the culture. It's mm-hmm. talking about mm-hmm. walking in and how you present right. yourself on a daily basis, and how those kids being able to handle a challenge face-to-face with the person, that's something we don't do very well, right? No. We have an issue with somebody. I mean, in Minnesota, we're great at this. I don't want to deal with the person. Like, it's not tools we've been given
Minnesota
as
nice.
People. Right. It's, yeah, Minnesota nice. It's not, many times, it's not a compliment. And we don't know how to deal with each other well when we have conflict. Having somebody being able to know how to face the person and sit down, and it's not fearful. That is a person you want on your team, right?
Yeah.
And when we have criminals, I mean, again, I work with men who have been arrested for domestic abuse, and they walk out, when I see them shift over in understanding empathy and not having fear to talk to the person or to have a conversation because they've gained tools, that's a whole different world. Their entire life is different.
You talk about making your community safer. That's how you do it. Not getting them off the street inside of a cell, because I've got 30 years of experience watching these guys.
Mm-hmm.
That's a momentary minute in the life of a community where you had somebody that did something that was maybe dangerous or often not dangerous to anybody but themselves, but you get them out of the community. Mm-hmm. But they're coming right back.
Right. And angrier. Like you said, now they're frustrated and mad, and now they feel fear even more so, because they know if something happens again, it's going to be twice as bad, and nobody's going to listen. They've already got a record. And
We have two pages of pieces of paper, front to back, of different jobs. You're not eligible with a felony. And, you know, these jobs actually could pay the rent. They're not Mickey D's, and it's not Taco Bell, and it's not, nothing against those jobs, guys. But if you want to try to support a family, or you want to try to pay off your restitution that you owe the community for, those jobs don't get it. They don't fit the bill. And what you learn inside is stuff about depression and fear.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care about you. You're not going to make it. They're going to pull the rug out from underneath you. And you might as well go back to slinging dope, because that's really where the money's at. And, oh, by the way, let me show you about my buddy over here who's doing that. And they get a community together themselves, because they know that most of society has marginalized them. And you're going to hear people out there say, well, yeah, and that's the way it should be. You know what? We're talking 2.4 million men, just men alone.
Mm-hmm.
So this number we're talking about, it's just a small portion, that's starting to get big. And those folks, what are they doing? They're having children, and they're introducing them to their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It's becoming bigger and bigger, and they're impacting the schools, they're impacting the workplace, and if we don't get in front of this a little bit and help folks maybe navigate this more effectively, and maybe have other ways of intervening into their criminality or their bad behavior or their poor work performance in a way that makes them and helps them learn to be different and maybe more productive, less criminal, better at school. Man, talk about making this community safe.
It really is.
Right.
And safety is huge. I mean, you know, regardless of where we go, safety is a word that comes up all the time, but also another word that comes up is money, right? So dollars and cents. How does this pay off? How does this save money? How would a restorative justice program save money for a county? How does a restorative practices, how can that actually work in a school system and reduce suspensions, reduce detention,
keep
kids in their seats? And so sometimes it isn't necessarily about safety or some of these other ideas that we have about these outcomes, but it's about these other things too that we have to keep in mind. And I think what Paul was saying earlier about the kind of status quo person that we see as a typical offender, right? Or a status quo student that we see as a student that's in an alternative school, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we have visions or ideas about who these people are.
Right.
And I have seen just the opposite. I have absolutely seen just the opposite. I have seen men in our local prisons. So our local federal prison in Duluth, one of our local state prisons near us in Moose Lake, I have seen men that are so invested in this restorative philosophy, that are so living what this means and sharing these ideas, and they cannot wait to get on into their community and give back and give back. And I hear this constantly. And just a small amount of time teaching them about these restorative concepts, whether it's a student or men or women who are incarcerated, that small amount of time can change somebody's life. And I want to share an example with you that I think is something so unusual that's happening in our community that I know really nobody knows about. There is a program called Inside Out at one of our local state prisons. And this program has incarcerated men who have been living and learning, training themselves in this idea about what restorative justice is. Working with students in one of our local alternative schools, talking about how the school to prison pipeline impacted them. And so we're bringing together men that are incarcerated with students at this alternative school, sitting in circle space and having them share their stories about what it's like to be in school, what it was like to be on the other end of suspension, what it was like to be kicked out of their school. And that is, it's an amazing, amazing opportunity for these people to come together. Not only that, but to have teachers and school administrators sit inside that circle and hear these conversations, it's actually changing teachers' perception about what it is, what it truly means to suspend somebody from school. I mean, it's an absolutely incredible program, and I want to make that known to our local community that there are amazing things happening with inside our prison systems using this restorative work.
So talk a little bit about that. Like, what are these guys saying is happening to them? You know, what is suspension doing to them? And then how are they responding in how they might be working with their current students differently?
Right. So what I have heard them say, that at a really young age, that they maybe started getting in trouble for something small in the school system. Maybe they brought something into the school that they weren't supposed to bring into the school. Maybe they pushed somebody and all of a sudden something happened. Maybe they were in detention for a day, or maybe they were suspended for a day. And they came back to school, and just being away, even if it was a day or two, they started feeling disconnected from their school community. Teachers started looking at them differently. Oh, this is so-and-so, and remember 2 weeks ago, he or she got into trouble, and now we have to kind of watch him or her a little bit more to make sure that, you know, nothing else bad is going to happen. Well, then let's say that another 3-4 months goes by and something else happens with the same individual. Well, all of a sudden, the student becomes labeled. And what I'm hearing from these men is this label, this being pushed out, feeling disconnected, not a part of. I hear them say often that I had nobody to go to. I had no place. School was the only place that I could go to feel safe. School was the only place that I could go to feel any kind of connection, but now I'm being pushed out of school as well. So where do I go? The only place that I have to go, or the only place that seemingly seems like a place that I can go, is maybe over here doing things that I really shouldn't be doing. Because if you don't want me in school and you don't want me at home, then I'm going to figure out how to make my name known in my community. I'm going to figure out a different way. And oftentimes those ways aren't positive. And so then they quit school, maybe, or they move out of their home and things just start unraveling. And many of them talk about how they tried really, really hard to gain kind of a foothold to come back in to school or back into feeling like they were connected in some way, but again, just felt so distanced. They were so far gone by that time that they didn't see any other route. So these stories are the stories that they're sharing with students in school systems. They're sharing these with teachers and administrators, and it's really, really shining a light on this kind of student and what he or she really needs, that they really need that connection mm-hmm. at school. And they've said over and over and again, just talk to me. Just give me a moment. I knocked on your door and you said you were too busy. And please just give me that time. Mm-hmm. So that's really what they're saying. And I think we learn, just as humans, we learn so much through story alone that oftentimes this isn't about, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. It isn't this easy kind of dynamic mm-hmm. or easy thing to understand. This is more about emotion. It's more about that connection. It's more about relationship and feeling a part of.
Mm-hmm. I think it's all about, I mean, truly, I believe it's all about relationships to some degree or another. When I was working in the restorative justice program with at-risk youth, one of the things that I always thought was, how come we're finding so much success? What is it that we're doing? You know, like, you know, often I wanted to go, oh, yeah, well, Jesus, just my great facilitation.
I'm sure it's your great.
Yeah, of course, of course. But what I think over time is what I found was that the process, especially circle process, just allows you to be with mm-hmm. each other. And what happens is that these relationships get formed that aren't this judgmental talking down to or talking to. We're talking with each other.
Right.
And I would share stories about some of the criminal stuff I did as a 15 and 16
year old. That makes such a difference to people when you are become human. You
absolutely.
Know, you're not above. You get to be part of life, and now you understand them, and oh, now yeah. you're doing this. So you're both on the same plane on some level.
Do you think I didn't try to take something from a store once, you know, in my life? Do you think I didn't do one of, you know, some of the stuff that you did? It's just... Mm-hmm. that you are still part of us. You are still with us. And how can we help you find a different response to this kind of behavior? Mm-hmm. Do something differently than what you're doing. And what would happen is that we would start to see these kids not come back. They would actually start to become successful. We're all successful? No, but what I will say is when they get into trouble again, the crime was much less. Mm-hmm. And so, and when they'd come and see me, they'd go, yeah, I shouldn't have done that. But they're willing to talk to me. We weren't standoffish with one another. It was, I'm getting invited to baby showers from some of these youth now that have gone off and become married, and they're successful. They're paying taxes. They're working. They're not in a prison taking up tax dollars. Mm-hmm. They're actually contributing to society. Now, tell me which is making our community more safe.
Right.
And one of the things I think that I will say about these is circle and restorative practice is so trauma-informed because most of the kids and most of the folks that we are working with are coming from a trauma background. They feel a lot of trauma. Mm-hmm. And sitting in space with them, using some of these techniques and processes, really breaks through a lot of the trauma or helps them become more resilient around some of the behaviors that they have to experience every day. Mm-hmm. You got to remember, a lot of these children, especially in the school system, all night long, people are partying in their house. They have their doors barricaded because adults are trying to get in. They're running the neighborhoods with no supervision whatsoever because mom and dad are usually chemically addicted or they're doing something which shows that their parenting skills probably need a little help. Mm-hmm. So these children are waking up in the morning, going to school, stepping over people who are passed out on the carpeting. Mom's got a needle hanging out of her arm or whatever the case may be. They show up for school, and then the teacher is going, how come you don't have a smile on your face? You're disheveled. Why are you sleeping, you bad student?
Right.
And I'm not even saying that teachers are looking at this, you know, from a lens of equal perspective. In other words, if they knew what this kid was going through at the night before,
right.
the response would be different. But
right.
I can't do that because that's not our policy, right. And this is how we do it.
You don't have time.
Don't
to
have
do
the
that.
Time because I got
to
get those ATC scores up, and if I don't have those scores up, the school's in trouble, and then.
Well, so your statement earlier, you had said, you know, when we're doing something, we are asking the question of what do we want the outcome to be, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That's a really important question to examine the answer to because it's. In one frame of thinking, we want the outcome to be, we want people to grow up and be thoughtful human beings and be part of their community and be good to each other. But really, most people are acting in the, what do I want the outcome to be? I want the kid to listen to me and do what they need to do to make my mm-hmm. job easier because mm-hmm. I don't have time for this. I got all these students. So if everybody, if we can't change the idea or understand, and I think mm-hmm. the important thing is going in and asking that question, because if the outcome is, I just want them to be a good boy
right.
or girl,
right.
that's a very different thing, and it's operating from a very different perspective on an outcome. I mean, I've done jobs where, you know, when you have a bunch of kids, the easiest thing is you just want them all to be good. Why? Because you've got to manage all these other kids. Mm-hmm. And so if they could just all be good, everything would be okay. But that's not the big picture. No. That is the moment-to-moment, get-me-through-the-day kind of thing. But that's not how the world... We are all operating on that. I just want them to be a good boy or girl in life, in a job, in how we manage... Many times, right? And you're trying to say, let's look at the bigger picture, because the point is we then all go home to our life, our world, our community, not to mention even just our job daily function. And if we don't have those new tools, I mean, I think, like you said, there's this magical age of 18. Mm. How many times you hear, really? Aren't you overdoing that behavior? You're 18 now. Mm-hmm. Well, wait a minute. If you never got... the experience. I mean, I've always been frustrated with that, but I don't know how to be that person. You know, you're 18, have a good self-esteem. Well, geez, where's the rule book for that? You know what I mean? It's if you don't have the new mm-hmm. software, mm-hmm. if you don't have the tools,
right.
you don't have, you don't know
you
even
don't
where
have
to
the tools.
Start. You just
don't,
you don't
have the tools.
Right?
If you don't have the tools, you don't have the tools. And if you look at now in neuroscience, right, especially if you're looking at the, around trauma and the brain and brain development, mm-hmm. That frontal, that decision-making piece of our brain that we use to make good and bad decisions is still being developed all the way up until our late 20s. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, at 18, when you say, hey, shouldn't you have enough empathy? Well, no, I am not developed enough
exactly.
to have good empathy.
I hardly know what that's about.
And when you talk to these kids, you know, you can see they're just... they're trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at Hannibal Lecter and Silence of the Lamb, you know, and everybody's going, and then you look at Helter Skelter, whatever his name was back in the 60s, and you come up with all of these horrific people that did really horrific things. You can probably put them on two hands, but yet we're responding to everybody as if they're these kinds of people, mm-hmm. and we're using all of these big, because we're seeing the only tool we have is this hammer, so every problem's a nail,
right?
And we're hammering these things out, and what we're doing is we're creating more problems for ourselves as opposed to fixing them. And you translate this to the workplace, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. I talk to supervisors and managers and CEOs all the time, and they're going, my God, it's an assembly line. You put bolt A into hole B, and you screw it down. How could this get so screwed up?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can this not work? This isn't that. And we're paying these people pretty decent money. Well, it's because your relationships with those workers are probably awry. When you're seeing a lot of these simple problems that need fix, it's not the problem. It's the people doing the work. If you don't have good relationships with each other, and if you're not actively seeking to do that in a school, in a justice system, in a workplace, what you're going to do is you're going to have problems on product, on outcomes for grades, and people... recidivating back into the community. All of those things are affected by that. But what we don't do in this country is we don't have time for that huggy, touchy, feely shit. We
right?
Oh, I forgot.
Oh no.
we don't want to spend any time on that because you know that's not what you do. But here's what it is: if you don't spend time on that, kids won't learn. Their outcomes are going to be bad. If you don't spend time in it, you're going to lose money in your company. You're going to have big turnover. People are going to be leaving you all the time because you're not addressing the things that needs to be addressed. And in the criminal justice system, you're not preparing them for the streets, so they're going to be coming back. And if people love to pay taxes, because I know everybody out there does, then that's the next thing people are going to start hammering on, because this criminal justice system is going to spend us into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I would much rather having somebody who worked in there and would only put those very unsafe folks in there, and everybody else, we need to figure out how to help them become society's people again, back mm-hmm. in, working, contributing. What are the things that are getting in the way? And we have to help them learn those things. Because if we don't, we're going to be spending a crap load of money that isn't going to do anything but perpetuate the thing we're spending money on.
Right. And I know, you know, sometimes when we talk about trying to do things differently, they say, well, we don't really know if it'll work. Mm-hmm. But what we know is this isn't working. What we've got isn't working, and we need to do something. You know, if the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and expecting a different outcome, we're saying to the criminals, well, you keep doing wrong things and you expect to have a different outcome. Well, criminal system, school system, work system is doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why? Yeah.
Well, in this county that we worked doing restorative justice, we used to schedule a full day for juvenile court. And when we started doing this kind of work,
uh-huh.
it went from a full day to a half day to some days no kids on the roster.
Wow.
At all.
That's cool.
Oh.
I think
massive.
Wow.
That's cool, because that speaks to numbers, it speaks to dollars, right?
Right.
And which is great, because that's going to catch somebody's ears. And I think for me, honestly, what the greatest thing that came out of this work was that we really started developing a whole community that started supporting youth in a different way and families in a different way. Not that anything that was done prior to was bad or ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
This was just a different way of looking at it. And we would have, you know, some, let's say that we had a young man that went through the restorative justice program, and yes, it's tough. Yes, you have to go through it. And I mean, you could opt out if you wanted to, but most of them decided to go through it. And they, if a friend of theirs, and we had a couple of these kids call, if a friend of theirs got in trouble, they would call the program and say, hey, I know my friend just last night,
yeah.
mm-hmm, you know, and you're probably going to be seeing him or her, and just talk to them, because I know that this program is going to be great for him. He really, really needs what you all are doing. We would have parents that would call and say, hey, their kid wasn't in trouble with the law, but
mm-hmm.
the parents would call. Maybe, you know, their son or daughter had been through the program maybe a year before. Parents would call later to the program and say, hey, can I just get some help here? I think I need a circle. I need a community
mm-hmm.
circle. And we had incredible, incredible support from our community volunteers. So we canvassed our county, asked people to volunteer in this program, because the program didn't have really any money to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was all primarily volunteer hours, and people showed up. People showed up every time we needed them, and they supported this program, still support this program like no other program that I've ever been involved in, because they saw the results. They felt like they were actually doing something that was fruitful, something that was incredibly valuable for their community, for youth in their community. And people, you know, we wonder, I mean, every once in a while I hear programs that say, how do you get volunteers? Because we're really struggling. We just can't get anybody to sign up. We never had that problem, because people were showing up at the door because they found it to be so incredibly valuable. And I think that
yeah.
in itself, shifted that whole county. Mm. It shifted, and we talk about culture of a workplace, or we talk about culture of a school. I really want to look at big picture, talking about culture of a county, mm-hmm. culture of a city. And there's ideas, there's frameworks being developed now in this restorative world out there around developing restorative counties. And I think it's a fabulous, fabulous idea. I think it's something that needs to be researched more, so that when we talk about all of our government entities inside a county, when we talk about local businesses, when we talk about nonprofits, we talk about our school systems, when we talk about our justice systems inside a county, if we're all coming to this idea that relationships matter, that this is the way we do business around here, I can imagine what can be accomplished.
Well, my gosh, if you've got your whole, you know, county, city, etc., on kind of the same page, and they all kind of understand that, and somebody kind of goes off the rails, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. it's a lot easier to gently have, and you have the tools to gently mm-hmm. have that conversation, because we're all human, and, you know, we get mad mm-hmm. and whatever, you know what you're supposed sure. to do, but, you know, whatever, to be able to have it, and everybody can be on the same page and be speaking kind of the same language and support each other and figuring that out. I mean, I think that's, I was through a training program last year where it was one of those things where you need people around you to also be in that program, where you kind of, A, not only lose the concepts yourself, but you don't have people supporting you with the same language and same thought mm-hmm. to help you stay on that path. And it's weird because it can be a scary path too. I mean, I think of, you know, cults probably work that way really well, but it's being able to have more people on board with the mindset mm-hmm. so that you can, everybody kind of goes, okay, yeah, that's the outcome we're looking for.
Right. Right.
Rather than, no, the outcome is just punishment.
Yeah.
You did something bad. It's punishment.
Yeah.
And so it does absolutely make sense. And so you don't have to live in your work world where you do this one thing, in your school world where you do this one thing. And we do that.
Yeah.
You know, this corporate, this kind of mindset mm-hmm. here and here. Mm-hmm. And then we do go out into the real world. And it feels, you know, when I think of the criminal system or whatever, mm-hmm. it is a different world that, you know, even men in my men's group, we talk about, you know, well, great, this stuff here. But then when we get dealing with the police or this system, and I think of even this was set in my men's group of how do we navigate the world, we're trying to be good people, we're trying to make the next best decision mm-hmm. and not to bring politics in it, but I still think this is a very logical answer or a logical question. You know, one of the guys says, we've got this president who says language, who speaks to people in ways that if I speak to somebody like that in an angry voice, I go to jail.
Sure.
You know, mm-hmm. I get in really big trouble. Mm-hmm. But here this guy's running our country and he's able to do that. How do I make sense of that? What does that say about who I am? Why do I have to be the perfect angel mm-hmm. and the person running the country doesn't? Mm-hmm. And I think we see those things and we see those disconnects in work. We see it in different layers of our workplace. Well, I did this one bad thing, but that guy stole hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Sure.
And we just say, oh, we're just going to cut half your bonus this year, you know. So it feels very unfair
right.
because we're not all looking for the same outcome.
Right.
No, right. It's kind of a caste system.
Mm-hmm.
Just
totally.
To a certain degree that, you know, if you have money and you have influence, if your skin is the right color,
mm-hmm.
there are privilege that comes with that. And one of the things that I'll say in what I like is about restorative justice is that there's an equating of status and folks. When you sit in space, all of that stuff gets stripped away. We become human beings with one another. And when we leave, we go back to our lives. But what it does is forever changes you when you sit in that space having those true conversations about what needs to be said. Now,
I want to add to that,
oh,
though.
Okay.
I think partly what you're talking about is reflecting the humanity through this process. And I was a victim of a crime a few years back. I remember going through the traditional court system, and I remember somebody from the system saying to me, don't be emotional, try not to cry,
mm-hmm.
hold your head up, say what you need to say, be quick about it, because the court doesn't have a lot of time. And are you sure? And questioning me, are you really, really sure? Are you certain you want to give your victim statement? Are you sure you want to do this? That was asked of me several times. And I had spent days working on my statement, what I was going to say, how I was going to say it, questioning myself as to whether I actually should say it.
Mm.
And to be asked whether or not I should share that statement, whether I thought it was in my best interest, to be told that I should not be emotional, mm-hmm. and, you know, to be real cautious as I, what I was sharing with the court, was stunning to me. You know, if we talk oftentimes about re-victimization, mm-hmm. you know, when going through this court process.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an advocate with me, and this advocate was part of this process that was asking me these questions. And I, of course, won't ever forget that experience, but I compare that experience, which I know many others have that same, very same experience going through the traditional justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And when I compare that to what I have seen within the restorative justice system, there is a place for tears. There is a place for questions to be asked and answered. There is a place for hope. There's a place for fear. There's a place for accountability to actually have, for true accountability to actually happen inside these restorative processes. I did not feel that as a victim in our traditional system. And I think that's a huge, huge, huge difference between what we're talking about here. If through a restorative process, we can provide some level of hope that things are going to get better, if through a restorative process, people can shed tears and shed their fears. So many times I've heard victims say, why me? Well, did this person choose my house to break into because if it was something that I did? Time and time again, people ask themselves this question. Mm-hmm. What was it about me that was so wrong that I had to experience this?
Mm-hmm.
You cannot ask those questions and have them answered through our regular court system.
Mm-hmm.
And restorative processes allows all of this to occur. And that's critical space. That's the element that we are missing in our justice system. It's the element that we're missing in our school systems. Where can a student and a teacher come together and you know, I had a teacher a couple years ago, a sixth grade student did something to her. You know, nothing major, but it was hurtful. The student apologized, and I remember giving him a hug. And the teacher looked at me, and she's a lovely, beautiful, beautiful woman, and said, I didn't think I could hug him. Is it okay for me to hug him? When have we lost this ability to care or show expression of even just honor towards somebody that apologizes to us? And it's the same thing in our workplaces. We have, oftentimes, we're becoming robots. Mm-hmm. We feed the beast, meaning we feed that computer constantly. We're writing reports, we're dismantling our relationships because of lots of reasons that I won't get into.
We have lots of examples.
The systems and the destructions that we do to each other in the workplace, because maybe I want that promotion and I don't, you know, I'm really, really, really wanting to move up in this business and I got to play the game, you know, to find my way through that.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't be relational with you. I can't be your friend. I can't be somebody that, you know, that you're close to, that you can share your secrets with, because, you know, it's not good for me. So we do this to each other in every structure and system that we experience, and it's time for that to go. It's time for humanity to come back.
Well, we have to start investing in humanity. In other words, these relationships that we've been talking about now for a while with you is what the investment is.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're looking at the problem, you know, The drug addiction is the shining light that we're looking at, but why do we have so many people becoming addicted? And that's where I want to do my work, not that we have somebody using an illicit drug and we're going to throw them away in prison because of it, and that'll learn them and they'll never do it again, right? Which is so much BS. Mm-hmm. What I want to know is, why is this country so prone to get on opioids? Mm-hmm. Why is this country wanting to lead the world in suicide rates? Why is this country doing what they do? And I'm believing that it's all about how we've deteriorated our relationships with one another, mm-hmm. and how we're not sitting in space making apologies, repairing harm, getting everybody who needs to be part of the conversation and investing in that. That means resources, that means money, that means time. But if you do that, you're going to make tons on the other side of it, right. all over the place. But why have we gone away from that?
Right.
I mean, I think of so many examples where when we intervene or we bring this kind of practice to an area, how it changes fundamentally how people interact with one another. And it gets better. It gets better. Wow. What do you know?
Right.
You know?
Well, when we, like you said, bringing back the humanity, and it's interesting to me when I think of, like, you were saying, there's just all this preparation for you to be able to make a victim statement, mm-hmm. and all the question, mm-hmm. and not only does it make you second guess everything you're thinking, feeling, experiencing, mm-hmm. but it also, it's that everybody's trained before they go on to explain what happened. How is this going to be perceived? Should you, don't cry, don't you, and then yeah. we get judged anyway, because I have heard this come out of the same person's mouth in different meetings. That person was emotional, so they don't really have the facts. They really don't have anything to say. Mm-hmm. The same person said, that person just came in with the facts. All they did was sit down and read their facts. They had no emotion.
Right.
So it's like, okay, so is it that we don't feel humanity from each other? Is it that we all are going into things so trying to be prepared because we're trying to guess everybody's outcome, but we don't even have a chance to be human? Because if we show our humanity, that's not good enough.
No.
You know, I had a gentleman who had to go to court to attempt to get custody for his kids. They were, you know, how do I go with this? How do I look like a responsible adult? Mm-hmm. He dressed up too much. They decided he looked like a pimp, and then he must be a drug dealer, and then he doesn't get his kids. He's like, all I want to do is see my kids. Like, mm-hmm. but I feel like it's a show, and if I don't do the show the right way for that person's eyes, mm-hmm. because it's all a guess, mm-hmm. if he would have gotten somebody else on the other end of those eyes, they might have saw that as being perfectly responsible and not an upstanding human being. And so it feels like everything is theater, mm-hmm. and we mm-hmm. don't get a chance, you know, we don't have the help, we don't have the resources. Like you say, you never get to talk to the person who victimized. And I know, you know, there's certainly the concepts of kind of that trauma. Mm-hmm. That, right. And but there's the man, if you had help, if you had a person who really knew how to help you have that conversation and have the time to get to know what the heck happened, mm-hmm. you get to see the humanity in each other, and they get to realize the person they hurt is a human, like you were, you know, saying before. It creates a whole different world. And I think, I know, like, again, running the men's groups, people say, I couldn't do that. I couldn't walk in a room. I would just see them all as jerks, and I couldn't even deal mm-hmm. with them as humans. Just, it just doesn't occur to me to think that way. And when you learn somebody's story,
right.
Yeah, obviously, it brings the human, like you say. When you understand why somebody did something, that matters, or it helps you to process it differently.
Our biggest group of volunteers, I think, that were coming into the restorative justice program were victims, and mm-hmm. and here's why. I mean, we had a couple of young men that were doing breaking and entering of occupied residencies, which is a felony, and it's on the higher end of a crime rate, which I have to give, I think, the county a lot of credit, just because we weren't just tackling the minor consumption, 12-year-old with a beer, whatever, you know. What we're dealing with is some pretty serious stuff, and we had a process with one of the young men. The other one refused to participate in the process with both sets of victims, because they went into two houses that night. They broke into a camper, and they broke into a house where mom and dad were sleeping. So we started a process with these victims and other volunteers, and what we found out was one of the victims was to the point where she was so sure that what she had done is invited these boys to break into her house, that her husband was having a hell of a time going out of town. He traveled for his work. And there was starting marital problems because of that kind of thing. And we started this process with them. And we worked through a lot of these issues, the tears, the emotions, all of the things that this child got to hear from these victims, that Christmas, the next Christmas, because we were with them for probably about, a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
That Christmas we came to, she invited him and us to her house for Christmas dinner. The guy who broke into her home.
Right?
Wow. And his parents.
Oh,
wow. The entire circle.
Jeez. What an amazing thing.
Dinner at her house. She would have not recovered to the degree I think she's recovered to, because she's a vibrant and just wonderful woman. This gal is full of life. And she was debilitated because of this, because she thought it was her. And so was the other couple. The other couple where they broke into the camper is that the guy who was getting his camper broken and was coming out of his house with a shotgun and was going to take out these kids with a shotgun because he didn't know. Mm-hmm. And his wife, you know what she was more worried about? And you would have never found this out in the criminal justice system. She said, I know that if he would have shot you, he would have never recovered. Mm. It still brings emotion to me. It was more she was worried about him protecting his property and having to kill a kid and knowing what that would have done to him and her family, as opposed to a camper being broken into. Mm-hmm. Now, the kid who went through the process, went in the military, and is doing pretty well. Had some bumps and scrapes on the way. The other kid's in prison. But we have one person now in society, you know, working. But moreover, we have a couple of people in the community who have healed from this, who don't now have guard dogs outside their houses because they understand what the crime was about. It wasn't, you know, we've got gang members, you know, and it's crazy, and we need automatic weapons at our house. No, we had two chemically addicted kids looking for money and prescriptions, and they happened to pick you. And they knew that now.
Right. That's a whole different kind of piece.
Our community's way safer.
Yeah. Right.
You know? But you can't. Well, you can. People don't understand what these people are about and what they're doing, and most of these folks who commit crimes are broken and are in need of
resources. They don't have, I mean, that's the thing. There's so many, you see
people need themselves up by their bootstraps.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And if you don't have boots or straps, you're kind of like, well, what do I do? And you know, we live in a society that says, well, figure it out, but I don't, until somebody's lived in that place,
expensive.
It's just not always realistic when you're fighting, you know, when you've got some people who were like, but I have four jobs and all I'm doing is trying to get by, or yeah, I'm trying really hard from this stupid thing that happened to me, or this thing that I did and I got in trouble for, and now I'm trying to recover from that. I'm spending all of my time and all of my life. Well, yeah, you shouldn't have done that thing. Okay, maybe that's true. But if we can go back to why that thing happened, and we can give people tools again to climb out much better. You know, it's all in so much of it's the circumstances, and we don't take the time to understand why. And again, I this is one example that I use, and I think it's an important and a very real one. The movie that I can never remember the name of that Will Smith is in, who has it's based on a real story. The guy had a kid, wanted to get the job, got this job on Wall Street, happened to have the right ins, the right help, the right timing, as I understand it, because I honestly haven't seen the movie, gets the ins and able to move up. Well, what does he do? He lives, and they show this in the movie, because this is a scene that I've seen over and over again. The dad is like living in a bathroom stall.
Right.
So he can go to pursuit of happiness. Okay, thank you. The dad goes off and tries to figure out how. And now the guy is you know, very wealthy. He's made a name for himself, and he's climbed out of his hole. But quite frankly, because he made the right connection. And he let his kid live in a bathroom stall. We look at him, he's a hero. He did everything possible. He, if we would have caught him, he would have been a child abuser.
Right.
And it's like,
sure,
all of that, it's you don't know which side of, if somebody is a good thing happens, they're a genius. If a bad thing happens, they're reckless and irresponsible.
Well, and he's the exception, not the rule.
Right, exactly.
Well, and I really feel compelled to speak to what you're saying. Well, I think one of the really frustrating experiences I've had a few of these experiences is that only certain people should be able to have the benefit of the restorative justice program because maybe haven't been in trouble before, or maybe their parents work for somebody that is part of the county system, and or so it's when I see some disparities in who can receive services, whether it's restorative justice or something else, I get really, really frustrated. And the conversation that I oftentimes will bring up is until it's you, until it's your child, because I can think of a few people right now that do not believe in this work at all, that I am acquaintances with. And don't think that it's holding youth accountable. Don't think it's fair to other kids maybe in the system. Think that it's too soft on crime for whatever perceptions or ideas that they have about the program. These are individuals that have never been part of the program or experienced it, by the way. But until it's their kid or until it's their family or themselves that's been victims, they feel like this isn't a valid or valuable process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so, so frustrating sometimes to try to kind of work that uphill battle about perception, about how some people see this as just really too soft and not a viable program. And it's a conversation that we need to continue to have happen. Like we were talking earlier, what is accountability? What are the outcomes that we're seeking? If we can continue to have those conversations and open up dialogue about that,
mm-hmm.
we'll be far, far further along in developing a more civil society than what we have right now. But we have to have those conversations. We can't be afraid to have those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about the cost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're sitting in Oak Park Heights, you're about $225 per day. Per day, 365 days a year. The Department of Corrections budget is $588 million for biennium 2019. Now, that isn't a small little chunk of number. It's not as big as other departments, let's say. But for a department that the only function they are is public safety. They're not even required to do much to help guys become better while they're inside. Their job is to segregate them from society, keep them behind a fence. That's what they do. And the results they're getting are dismal. Dismal. You know, and it's no slam on my correctional brothers. I mean, it's no slam on them. It's just the truth.
Right.
You cage people. You don't do much with them. You introduce them to other folks who do the same thing or maybe better.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've got is more people wanting to do the same thing when they get out.
Well, that's all. If that's maybe all they know,
right,
then they go back to what you know. You know, if you only have those tools again in your toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of the people who say, you know, some people deserve it and some people don't. And I think, but, you know, if somebody is committed a crime over and over and over again, it's the question of what is making them do that? And do we label them a bad person? And there probably are some people who have mental illness that makes the actions that they do really consistently bad, and they're maybe not going to get better. But sometimes when you discover that somebody just doesn't understand or has never been able to learn how to use particular concepts of functioning in society to do something different, then they have this whole different outcome. And if they never get that chance, it's good if we can help somebody right away, but it's to not give people the chance to, like you say, when they have positive experiences, even if they do commit something again, it's usually on a smaller level. It's
right.
And anything you can do to back that up And some people have just a complete turnaround. Well, that's just better for everybody.
It's a safer community.
Right.
It's better for all of us.
Right.
I want to take us back a little bit to, I don't know why I feel like a transition, but I feel like a transition into talking about students, these student ambassadors in our Cloquet Alternative program, because some of them feel, many of them feel that they have been thrown away. If you're, you know, if you are needing to be moved to an alternative school, there's a connotation that comes with that, or a belief system or a labeling that comes along with that. And at CAPE, which is the Cloquet Area Alternative Education Program, they are now 3 years into their whole school approach to utilizing restorative practices. So they have been doing this, becoming this restorative idea, this restorative framework for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact that that has had on the students, on the staff as well, because when we talk about bringing restorative practices into a school, it's not only for the students, but it's for everyone. It is for everyone. And when you can change that entire culture and people start learning, like you were saying earlier, how to have these conversations with each other, these students are asking for their own circles. These students are circling up without the support of teachers or other circle keepers. They're going to a student ambassador who is a student at CAPE that's trained in conflict resolution. They go straight to these students and say, hey, I need a circle. And usually within 5 to 10 minutes, something that could have taken hours for the school to respond to, these students are navigating on their own without a need for adult support.
And that's what we want.
It is what we want. And because they're learning this skill. So every time they're in circle, they're learning how to have conversation.
It's practice.
It's practice time and time again, how to do it well.
Right.
And I can imagine, I mean, the benefit of that for our community is just huge. But for those students, is absolutely huge. I mean, this is a skill that they can take out. This
oh
is something
gosh.
They put on their resume.
Heck yes.
You know, I mean,
absolutely.
It's absolutely all of that.
Yes.
So I just am so, I'm so proud of that school. I'm so proud of those students for actually even taking on that role as an ambassador, because it's... takes time for them too.
Right.
Takes time out of their day.
Right. Well, and you mentioned the teachers, and I think that is never to be understated. But I understand that it probably doesn't get stated so much, that it is teachers, the workplace. It is everybody that benefits, because the teachers. What do I hear from teachers or people that I know who went to school to be teachers, did their practicum, and said, "Yep, nope, not doing that. I want to teach.
Right.
I don't want to discipline. But
yes.
that's all I did
yes.
was discipline."
Right.
Yeah. We've lost some of our best teachers because of that. If they have a different way to do this, we maybe will get much better teachers, because the teachers, this is, I think, some of, I can think of people that I've known who are people who probably would fit beautifully into the restorative
mm-hmm.
model, because,
mm-hmm.
yeah, they get to spend their time teaching. And this becomes a part of teaching, but they have different tools. And they don't have to follow these rules about discipline and do
right.
this. And,
right.
and it's kind of the us and them and creating that. It's the, okay, let's work with this together. It becomes still a thing that still brings everybody
right.
together.
And well, it impacts the community,
yeah.
right? I mean, these behaviors don't happen in a vacuum.
Right.
These behaviors don't occur that nobody else ever sees or are not affected by it.
Right.
And they're all watching what we're doing with them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are maybe not doing the good thing when they see that. But they're also now understanding that maybe there's a different way to address behaviors that aren't so good than the normal way.
Mm-hmm.
Because if all I get is you screaming at me and sending me off to a room, and I'm a 17-year-old kid, I'm not learning a lot about that other than maybe I know I don't want that to happen to me, or maybe, shoot, I need tomorrow off. This is a way out, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't care about my grades or what happens. I'm one of those kids that they deem as bad anyways, so okay. why not do it? So, yeah, these behaviors affect teachers, they affect other students, and they affect the community that they live in.
And I think you said it earlier, Jean. I can't remember if we made this point already or not, but schools are workplaces too, right? And I think we forget that schools are workplaces for the people that work there. Mm. I mean, we often we just think, oh, that's a school, and we forget that it's a job as well. Mm-hmm. And being that it's a workplace, teachers have conflict with each other mm-hmm. as well. I mean, right. you know, just like any other workplace. And so when we embed these restorative processes inside the school and we say this is for staff as well, the conversations that I have heard when teachers are in conflict with each other and how they too are developing and strengthening their relationships and their bonds with each other through conflict that they're experiencing with each other mm-hmm. is amazing to me because they're actually doing it as well. They're doing that with each other as well. And so, you know, it's like any workplace when employees aren't getting along, it impacts the product, right? Mm-hmm. It impacts the outcome. And students feel that just like anybody else would in a workplace. And so when there's a strong body of staff that are getting along, have good relationships with each other, you see teachers walking down the hallway and joking with each other and having fun and say, hey, I'll see you in circle in a couple hours, and they can't wait to get there. Mm-hmm. That is a huge culture shift. It's an amazing culture shift, and it helps with the learning for the students.
My gosh, yes. Yeah. Oh, man, having a teacher who's happy makes the whole world of a difference in a classroom.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think is important to talk about is how, if you have a school or you have a county that's interested in a diversion program for youth that has some restorative, a restorative nature to it, or they want to start designing a restorative program as a diversion for the justice system, you know, how do people actually do that? What does it look like? And I think that's kind of a really important piece of the conversation here. So in starting off with the justice system and thinking about youth diversion, there are a lot of ways in which counties or county entity can actually run a diversion program. One way is to develop a restorative justice program. And there are many other types of programs they can do, but restorative justice is one pathway to offer for youth diversion. And I think, you know, if there's an entity out there that's considering that, there are a lot of implementation questions. There is a lot of navigating of changing structure. There's a lot of work to be done around what is it that you're really truly seeking, and is restorative philosophy really the right approach that you want to embed? And also, you know, some of the counties that we've been working with, as we've mentioned before, have really taken this idea of restorative philosophy to its fullest degree, saying that we'll use restorative diversion for felony level crimes, and that's pretty unusual. Some counties have opted to say that we want this restorative diversion program to be pre-charged so that youth wouldn't even be charged with a crime, you know, because oftentimes there's a charge, but then the case is dismissed. Mm-hmm. Some counties are going the direction of saying we want a pre-charged diversion program. So there's a lot of questions, a lot of implications to making a decision on what pathway to go down if you're thinking about restorative philosophy as a diversion program in a county. And I think not any different for a school that is thinking about implementing restorative practices or maybe becoming a restorative whole school program. There are a lot of implications and implementation questions that need to be asked and answered to along with that, because it's, you know, one of the philosophies that Paul and I have is that this is far more than coming in and doing a two-day training and saying, okay, well, now you're trained in circle and you all are good to go. You know everything you need to know.
Right.
Because it is not like that at all. There needs to be continued support by experts in the field that can assist and guide staff and students and people that are working in the justice system as they learn and grow to the full implementation of the possibility of what restorative justice and restorative practices looks like.
Right. You don't go to marriage therapy once and call it good and have it all figured out, right?
Right. Exactly. And that's all about relationship, right?
Right.
I mean, and that's really what we're talking about. And don't forget the workplace, too, because the workplace is the same thing. I mean, we design and implement and help folks implement integrated conflict management systems within workplaces, which is the same philosophy around restorative justice and restorative practices. And it moves into developing solid, good relationships with folks so that they can get the work done that they need to get done well. And I like to sum up workplaces like this. Have you ever worked at a place where you got up in the morning and you're going, damn, looking forward to going in today. And, oh, we got this great project that I'm going to. And, oh, boy, I can't wait to hear more about what happened to George or Sheila or whatever. And we're all doing this together. And the work is smooth and you're creating great products and everything's moving in a great direction. But you've also been to those places that you dreaded to go to, that you look for reasons not to go in. And what we're saying is that those workplaces don't spend a lot of time on developing good, strong relationships with their staff. And we think it's just as important to invest that time and energy and resources into that so that your product is better, so that kids can learn, so that criminals can come out of a justice system and be successful. You can't just push something on people without some sort of philosophical idea around building strong relationships, either with your community or your workplace or in the school. And I think we don't value that enough, and I think it's one of the reasons why we're not having very good success with it.
Well, and it's why people, you know, end up leaving jobs or whatever. I think it is that question of what does the, you know, in an employer situation, what does the employer want their outcome to be? If their outcome is, I want the project to go through, I want to make more money, we need 10%, you know, more money this year. If that's all you're out, and I just want my people to do that, versus when the mindset of when my people leave this company, they are a better person than they walked in, and they're going to be a great employee for the next one. You keep your employees, right? It's that investment, and it's and it gets them to come to a job that, man, I don't love my work, but man, I love seeing my people. I love that, and I want to do the best to this job that I don't love. It's a totally different mindset, and it's a dedication that you cannot pay for.
Well, look at Google. Look at all of these places where they're looking for this talent. What are they doing? They have daycares on site. They have stores that they want people to go to. They got places where they skateboard, where they have exercise. They provide a lot of things. Now, not all companies can do that, but wouldn't it be nice to be able to set space aside for when Bill and Joe get over an argument about who stole my pizza out of the refrigerator? Hey, listen, I've facilitated processes around a Donnybrook that occurred in a parking lot because of a taken pizza out of a refrigerator.
Hey, man, pizza's important. I don't know. That did not go well with me. My last pizza, raccoon cocoa pizza. Ooh.
And it was
not going to go well.
And it was. And the impact of the work community between those two peoples was unbelievable. And how that impacted everybody else around them.
Right.
Huge.
Right? Oh, gosh. It's so huge. And we know those examples. We see those examples. We feel those examples. When they're there, they're so present.
Right.
Yes.
I've had people talk about stuff that happened at a workplace in tears, describing this horrific event that happened before they were even hired, and they heard it from somebody else. That's what we call an institutional legacy. Well, because those things never leave if you don't attend to them.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Please talk about what you guys do, how you work with people, how people can either connect with you or find out if they want to connect with you, or do you do any presentations to about, you know, restorative justice, so somebody can just even get a better idea of how does this fit in our workplace or
sure.
whatever. Talk about that, please. Yes.
Well, the services that we offer, we do mediation, we do organizational development around conflict management and relational, what we like to call relational ecology, because we like workplaces, schools, and criminal justice systems to concentrate on relationships, and we do training around relational learning series in workplaces. We do and design and implement restorative practices in schools. We do and design and implement restorative justice programs for the criminal justice system. I've been raised up in the criminal justice system basically since college, but we do all of that work in all of those venues built and designed around restorative philosophy. And we have a website. Mickelson Consulting is out there, and it's out there in the ethos on the web. I know that we are crazy busy.
That's good. I'm glad to hear it. That makes me happy. That gives me hope for the world.
Always love to entertain and talk to folks about maybe a different way of responding to issues, especially around this whole idea of accountability. Mm-hmm. You know, I love going into workplace, and I love going into schools, and I love going in the criminal justice system. And her picture exercise is fantastic because everybody's different. Everybody's not on the same page. But yet we expect that we are. And then what we do is we judge each other when we approach it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the workplace, it's amazing how what people perceive accountability. Is that a punishment? Is that time off? Is that a bad eval? Or maybe is this an opportunity for us to learn?
Mm-hmm.
And what is accountability in all of these different venues? Nobody talks about what the definition is. We just assume we know it.
Mm-hmm.
Go to a school. Watch a teacher who comes up to a kid. This happened. A kid was out there hitting a hockey stick with a pop can down the hallway. And this one teacher walked up and says, "You put that stick away right now and you get out of this hallway." And the kid just kind of walks away but goes to the next floor and does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Another teacher then walks up to the kid and goes, "Hey, man, come here. You know, can you do me a favor? You're bothering a lot of the folks around, but I'd really appreciate it if you do me a favor and put that stuff away." And the kid immediately did that. Guess what happened? The teacher who yelled at the kid and the teacher who confronted the kid, right, got into a huge fight over who didn't support whom in dealing with this child. And there was all of this chaos around why you didn't support me and why you went at it a different way. And those are the kinds of things that happen because nobody has sat down and said, what are we trying to do?
Mm-hmm.
We want the kid to stop hitting the pop can down the hallway. And does it really matter, the intervention?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the important thing?
Right. Well, it's that question of I want the child to listen to me and do what I say and just get it. And I get it. That's the fast way
authority.
To do it, right? Right. You want the quick. We talk about fear. If you can control by fear, well, it's easy.
Right.
It's not pleasant for anybody.
Right.
But for one person, it gets the job done.
Yes. Yeah. But the chaos and the conflict that was created.
Right.
Because we didn't know. And we're not together about what our outcomes are focused on. We're more on how our delivery is and why we should support one another. And that's accountability to me. But it's not to him.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the anger and stuff that rose up out of that just because we're not doing that. And you look at, and the prison system is the same way. What's holding a guy accountable? All this, stick him in a cage for 36 months and he's going to come out a new and wonderful man?
Yeah. Yeah, we don't. Well, if you think that punishment solves the problem, that's not how that works.
A lot of people think accountability is punishment.
We'd see less people in prison if that were actually the fact.
Right.
Right?
Right.
You go.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. If
the proof
works.
Is in the pudding that is not working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we have to do something different. If we want different outcomes, and I think I see things differently because of the work I do now,
sure.
that I see that change is possible,
sure.
you know, And you don't, again, it's one of those things you don't understand until you've been in it, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You don't totally see what's possible. And it's so exciting to see that it's possible. Like, I have so much, the people that I work with my men's groups, give me hope.
Yeah.
They give me hope because I see these people walk in crabby and pissed off. And hate the world and don't deserve to be there, blah, 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 and all those things because they have been treated crappily by the justice system and because there is no connection, there's no humanness that they feel, right? I'm not there, but that's what they say. Mm-hmm. To walking out completely, 27 weeks later, completely different perspective on the world.
Right.
Completely different perspective on being on our group. And that gives me hope because they can quantify that in actual words and how they operate in the world.
And
you think about truly how little time it truly takes to, I mean, if you're talking 27 weeks, I don't know if you meet weekly for 2 hours or
weekly,
3 hours.
Yeah, weekly, hour and a half.
Times that, whatever that is, mm-hmm. and then think about the amount of time we spend on the other end doing these other things. And when we talk about sitting with this young man and all the others in part of the circle for a year and a half, it was once a week for 2 hours, and then it was every other week for 2 hours for maybe the last 6 months. It's not that much of an investment of time, but the payoff is huge.
Mm-hmm.
It's exponentially huge.
Well,
and so,
the people around him that he connects with, how he responds to them.
Yes.
We talk about if you treat people differently and do things differently, they will respond to you differently. Mm-hmm. Well, he's out there doing that,
right?
He's starting the positive ripple.
Right.
Then he has kids, he has neighbors, he has family.
Right.
He's doing something that's positively effective. Is it going to solve the world problems? Probably not.
No.
But my gosh, if that means three other people don't go to jail because he had some effect
mm-hmm.
that adjusted them, and that's real.
Right.
That's real.
40 and a half hours
uh-huh.
to change a life is what you do. 27 weeks, an hour and a half is 40 and a half hours.
So
it's one working week we're putting into these men that makes our community safer and actually helps them succeed. You're telling me a week is a week of working days.
Right.
That's it.
Right. Right. And but we'll toss them in jail for years and we complain about them living off the system, quote unquote.
Right.
Well,
how
can we invest?
Right.
How do we find them? We find so much money for so many things.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be a way
to
do this. If it's not, if people aren't worth it, then what are we doing here?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I agree.
Yeah. That's
all
a
right.
Great place to land.
Yes.
Thank you.
If you want to connect with Lorraine and Paul, you can find them at MickelsonConsulting.org. That's MICKELSON consulting.org. So many great questions. I love the tool that she talked about asking people to draw justice. Like, I just think that's so fascinating, and I'd be curious to know what I would draw if I was asked that question out of the blue at a county fair at various ages. I'd be very curious. I love that their work is trying to create a more complete and positive picture of what the word justice means to so many people. Because for many people, it's not a comforting statement. So that's very exciting. It seems like there's a lot of opportunity to do justice, law, punishment, so much better. And there are people having visions and trying to make that happen. So yay! Thank you again so much for listening. You are invited to keep the conversation going on the Facebook post, or send me an email if you have questions or thoughts, or post a comment underneath the show notes. It is great to hear from you and your thoughts on the episode. So thank you so much for those who have done that. And again, we invite you to join in the conversation. So before I go, I have a joke I want to share that my phone told me the other day, a sentence we probably didn't imagine ourselves saying, 10 years ago? A joke my phone told me the other day. Here's the joke. What is a dog called that does magic? A labracadabrador. I know, it's bad, but it made me laugh. So I'm sharing it so you can either have a groan or a laugh too. Up to you. I'm good either way. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful week. We will see you next time. Listen in next week when our guest is going to be Carrie Beckin. She is going to share her pretty intensive life transition story. And she works with folks now, especially in the queer and trans community, who are overcoming religious trauma and just challenging life transitions. So check it out. Beyond that, we're going to have mold eradication, and we're going to be talking about food allergies, and there's going to be some other stuff mixed in there as well. So keep an eye out going forward. Until then, may you continue to find the pieces that fit beautifully and work synergistically into your health and wellness puzzle. Take care.